fact that we're starting later than the schedule said causes me to make a very difficult decision about whether to leave out certain jokes. Probably that would be unwise. Better to leave out substance than to leave out jokes. What? No, but there's somebody speaking afterwards in this room. Okay. As you all know, Rivka had a difficult pregnancy. And she went to consult God. She was disturbed, obviously. And she went to consult God. And God said to her, there are two nations in your womb. Shnei goyim bevitneich. By the way, when I get to the time when you need the handouts, I'll stop for a few moments and we'll hand it out again, so you don't have to come forward right now. Shnei goyim bevitneich, ushnei le'umim imeayich yiporedu, ula'om ila'om ya'emotz, v'rav yavot sa'ir. Right, there are two nations in your womb, two nations will separate themselves from your womb. And one of them will prevail over the other, and the elder will serve the younger. The real interpretation of this passage I learned from Sefer HaBadicha V'Hachidud, which is a 3-volume collection of Jewish jokes, at a time when Jewish jokes were Jewish, not Borscht Belt, but Jewish. My father had this book, and you know, you can't read a book like that straight from beginning to end. You can't read a series of jokes, but if you read it judiciously, it's really very good. Anyway, I once told this joke. I told this joke more than once. I once told it to a Litvak who confirmed the stereotype of Litvaks by being offended by it rather than laughing. But the question is, how do you know that it's better? Let me say one other thing first. I don't normally use the word goy, no, seriously. I don't think it's an appropriate term to use normally. In this joke, I have to use it. The question is, how do we know that it's better to be a goy than a Litvak? And the answer is that we know that when Rivka was pregnant, she was having a difficulty. And Rashi tells us, and Chazal tell us, why when she passed a base medrash, one of them tried to get out. When she passed a base of Avodah Zorah, the other one tried to get out, and she was upset. And we assume at this stage of the story that she assumed that one is a goy for obvious reasons, and the other is a litvak because they're always running to the base medrash. And we think, of course, that she's upset about the goy. So what happens? She goes to consult God, and God says to her, Shnei goyim bevitneich. Both goy, and she's happy. So you see that she was upset about the litvak. Somebody else to whom I told this told me a different version, which was kind of, you know, has a somewhat more serious point, and that is that when the Mormon temple was being built in Jerusalem quite a number of decades ago, and there were demonstrations, there was one Rosh Yeshiva who did not want his students to go to the demonstrations, and he proved this by citing this story, and he asked, why did Rivka assume that there is a problem? Perhaps there was only one child, and he was going to the Beis Medrash to learn, and to the Beis Avodah Zorah to demonstrate. And from this, you see, he said, that a good Jew does not go to demonstrations. This promise of Rav Yavod Sa'ir, to temporarily become serious, this promise of the Rav Yavod Sa'ir raises interesting questions about the later deception that Rivka orchestrated, since we need to ask ourselves, whether she told Yitzchak about this assertion that she heard from God, in which case he should have known that that primacy was promised to the younger brother. And second, was her own behavior driven not only by her perception that Yaakov deserved the bracha, but by her sense that she has to actively involve herself in the fulfillment of this promise, of this divine promise. There are no definitive answers to these questions. One thing that was noted by Kasuto and probably by others as well before him, although I haven't noticed it before, is that Rav Yavod Sa'ir is ambiguous. We normally read it, as it's certainly intended to be read, straightforwardly, as the older will serve the younger. But there is nothing preventing you from translating it exactly the opposite. Rav, as the object of the verb, and Sa'ir, as the subject of the verb. So there was an opening, as there sometimes is in certain kinds of prophecies, to read the passage differently. And one could argue that Yitzchak, who for his own reasons, whatever they were, wanted to give at least physical primacy to Esav, read it that way. And of course, the other possibility, which is not for today, is the view that Yitzchak never intended to give the true blessing of Abraham to Esau. Rather, the promise he gives, or the blessing he gives to Yaakov at the beginning, is a blessing of physical success and primacy, while it's only when he is speaking to Yaakov at the end of the parsha and knows that he is Yaakov does he say that I am giving you Birkas Avraham. In any event, this promise of Rav Yavod Sa'ir and the primacy of the younger over the older plays a central role in Jewish-Christian interactions from the early years of Christianity, at least through the end of the Middle Ages, and in some sense to this very day. My father-in-law told me, I think it was, that there was a melamed that he had as a child who used to curse Rivka when he got drunk on Purim. And what he said was that all our problems are a result of Rivka. Because what did Yitzchak tell Esav when he came and he said, you know, Havrocho achasi l'cho avi barcheni gam oni avi? He gave him a bracha, mitala shemem yam oshavecha v'gomer, and v'yok hasher tarid u'forak ta'u lo me'asav arecha, which is not an easy thing to passage or phrase to translate, but as it's understood by Rashi and Chazal, if Yaakov does not observe the Torah, then the roles will be reversed, and said this Melamed, that's the reason why we are subjected now to Esav. And so he said, if she had not deceived Yitzchak, and the brachos had been given in reverse, how long would Esav have observed the Torah? He said, 10 minutes. And then we would have been in much better shape than we are now. Now, what is extremely interesting about the figures of Yaakov and Esav is that they create could be called a clash of typologies. Typology is a fancy word meaning that a biblical figure or event foreshadows something later. In this case, Jews, for understandable reasons, regarded Yaakov as Israel. Not hard to see why. And Esav as Rome and then Christendom. And that is hard to see why. Christians argued that they are the true Israel. Esav as the older brother refers to the Jews. Now, this argument emerges out of an observation in Sefer Bereishis, which is correct. Namely, that there is a theme in which the younger brother is preferred over the older. I mean, that's a real theme in Bereishis, and how that works and why is an interesting question in its own right. It's a legitimate issue to address. You have Kain and Hevel. You have, without getting involved in ambiguous cases, you have Yitzchak and Yishmael. You have Yaakov and Esav in this paradigmatic case. You have, arguably, Yosef and his brothers. The final pair in Reishis is Menashe and Ephraim. Christians argued that this demonstrates that the younger brother, which is the church or Christendom, is to be preferred over the older brother, which is the synagogue, or, as they put it, Israel according to the flesh. The Jews are, of course, carnal Israel. They are Israel according to the flesh. But there is an Israel according to the spirit, and that is the younger brother, as this theme demonstrates. There is even a particularly sharp observation made by a second century churchman who pointed out that when Yaakov places his right hand on Ephraim and his left hand on Menashe, and Yosef objects, what was he doing? He made the sign of the cross. Sikelet Yadav. He made the sign of the cross, thus demonstrating the meaning of this theme in Bereishis explicitly. Now, this Christian perception had significant legal ramifications for medieval Jews, not quite as significant as we might imagine, because the prohibition against Jews holding positions of any authority was not always observed rigorously. By positions of authority, I don't mean only in government, but this even applied to the prohibition, according to some churchmen, of Christians working for Jews in a Jewish home. And if that had been rigorously enforced, there would have been fairly serious social and economic consequences for Jewish households. Still, even if it was not rigorously enforced, it was a serious issue. It sometimes was enforced. And so even on the level of daily life, this typology mattered. Now, I said that it's difficult to understand why Jews would identify Rome and hence Christendom with Esau. We take this so for granted, that Esau, Edom, is Christendom. I mean, not every Jew on the street takes it for granted, but people who have been exposed to rabbinic texts to a reasonable degree take this for granted. It's in Rashi, HaTorah. It's all over the place, and so we tend not to ask ourselves why. What does Esau have to do? What does Edom have to do with Rome, let alone with Christendom? Now, as we'll see maybe in one of the handouts later on, where this is actually cited by a Jew, Jews could cite texts in Ovadia. Edom is said to stand by and watch the destruction of the temple without intervening. Elsewhere, you have a stronger verse about Edom, Homrim Oru Oru Ad HaYesod Bo, and so Edom somehow is involved in the destruction of the temple. Whether isolated verses like this can really in themselves produce such a typology is questionable, and I think that this emerges out of a kind of need for a symbolic counterweight to Yaakov, and that is certainly Esau. That's shot, pretty much, not only in these stories in Bereishis, but later in the Tanakh as well. Esau is sometimes set up as a counterweight to Yaakov, and since that counter force in the time of Chazal was Rome, and you had these verses that you could appeal to, you had some basis for this particular Jewish typology. And then, as Rome becomes Christian, Edom becomes Christian as well. Now, when Jews were really sort of, when they, not too many Jews actually, but some Jews in the Middle Ages, were troubled by this. And there develops a Jewish story whose basis is very difficult to determine, other than some efforts to explain this typology, that the Emperor Constantine, who was the first Christian emperor, was an Idumean or an Edomite. In another version, he was converted to Christianity by an Edomite priest. So there was some kind of story that Jews were able to appeal to, although it hardly strikes one as pshat. Now, this issue feeds into another matter that is connected to Jewish-Christian interaction, but goes well beyond it. The book of Daniel speaks about four kingdoms, four beasts who will succeed one another, and the angel explains to Daniel that these four beasts represent four kingdoms. And the final kingdom is defeated or displaced by the Am Kadishe Elyoni, by the nation of the holy ones, presumably the Jewish people. And so, for reasons both messianic and involving the interaction with Christians and Muslims, Jews struggled to decide what these kingdoms are. Now, in Chazal, it appears that the kingdoms are Bavel, then Madayu Faras as a single kingdom, and then Yavan, and then Edom, Rome. In Muslim countries in the Middle Ages, the omission of Islam seemed problematic. And so we have medieval Jews like Abraham Ibn Ezra who rethink this interpretation and tell us that the first kingdom is Babylonia, as it was earlier. The second is Madayu Faras, as it was earlier. And the third one, we have a good English word for this, the Greco-Roman world. Right? As you collapse Yavan and Rome, if you wish, Edom, into a single entity, and that leaves room for the fourth kingdom as Ishmael, or Islam. For reasons both, I would say, for reasons that are rooted both in a kind of conservative ideological stance of not wanting to modify Chazal's typology, and the historical rollback of Islamic control from Spain, the Ramban defends the old typology and argues that Daniel was not being told the names of every single kingdom that will exist between his time and the coming of the Messiah. He was given a vision which described four kingdoms, the fourth of which would endure until the Messianic age. And that was enough. He wasn't told the detailed history of other kingdoms that would arise before the Messianic age that are coterminous with the fourth kingdom, namely Edom. This identification of Christendom with the fourth kingdom of Daniel impinges on another question that is a very interesting one, I think, and is not my primary theme here, but it's relevant, and I think it's of considerable interest. What is going to happen to Gentiles at the end of days? What will happen to them? part of the answer to this question could be sought in an interpretation of Daniel and its description of what happens to the fourth kingdom. Now, let me first say that there are a variety of Jewish views regarding this question, which triggered an enormous controversy over what is probably the most controversial article on medieval Jewish history written in the last generation, though this part of it was not the most controversial part of it. But some of you no doubt know, although there's no reason why most of you should know, that Yisrael Yuval, now of the Hebrew University, wrote an article in the very early 90s that appeared in Tzion, which is a scholarly journal, called Hanakam V'Haklala, Hadam V'Ha'alila, right? Vengeance and curse, blood and the libel. The vengeance and the curse, the blood and the libel. The enormously controversial part of the article was the latter part, in which he said that Ashkenazic Jews, at least their chroniclers, assert or believe, imply strongly, that Jews killed their children during the First Crusade in order to get God angry at Christians so that he would take vengeance on them, and that Christians found out about this and concluded that if Jews will kill their own children, they'd kill Christian children too. Okay? You can imagine that this article aroused, shall I say, a certain amount of concern in some circles. Let me back up and say that my distinguished brother-in-law, David Schatz, who has an extremely creative sense of humor, once said that he was going to print up a business card for himself that would say, David C. Schatz, licensed epistemologist with an emergency phone number. So I once almost printed up such cards for him for his birthday, but I was too cheap. It turned out that I would have to. Maybe I should have done it. But I did tell him that he may not have gotten an emergency phone call as an epistemologist, but I received an emergency phone call as a medieval Jewish historian. At 10 to 6 one morning, the phone rang. It was not 10 to 6 in Jerusalem. The person who was in charge of running Tzion, who was not himself a scholar, but is a sort of executive director of Shazar Institute, called me to say that they are publishing a special double issue of Tzion to react to Yuval's article. And they have a long article by a person who was then finishing a doctorate in either Oxford or Cambridge on the attitudes toward these Jewish behaviors in Christian chronicles. And they had to decide whether to publish it. It was in English. They would have to translate it. David Ruderman, who was now at Yale, was then at, I'm sorry, now at Penn, was then at Yale, was about to go to the airport from Jerusalem. So they wanted to know if I would referee this article if he brought it to me. So anyway, this gives you some sense of the urgency associated with this issue. The first part of the article that was also controversial, although less so, was one in which Yuval argued that Ashkenazic Jews, well, let me start with Sephardic Jews, that Sephardic Jews envisioned an end of days in which the nations of the world would convert to Judaism, while Ashkenazic Jews envisioned an end of days in which non-Jews would be wiped out. And he really did formulate it that strongly. There were reactions to this as well, arguing that Ashkenazic Jews did not all or even most have this view of the total destruction of non-Jews at the end of days. One of the interesting texts that was cited in this context was the hymn that we say during Chazaras HaShatz on Yom HaNoraim, which was an Ashkenazic hymn, the hymn of the Esoyu Chol Le'Ovdecho, which, if you remember it, describes according to the Aleph-Bei. So there are 20 phrases to this effect, that at the end of days, all the nations of the world who have been in error until that point will recognize the God of Israel. Right, just in case somebody doesn't remember some of the Esoyuchol Avdecha Vivarchu Shem Fodecha, and later on it says V'nasucha Misnasei L'chol L'rosh V'saldu V'chi Lafanecha. Earlier it says V'yomru Tamid Yigdal Hashem, and they'll get rid of their Atzabim and so on. So there is an Ashkenazic piece of liturgy that shows that Ashkenazic Jews did not envision the destruction of all non-Jews. Now, generally speaking, I think that most medieval Jews believed that non-Jews would recognize the truth of the Jewish religion at the end of days. They would not, for the most part, become Jews in the full sense, but they would survive as separate nations, would be subordinate to the Jewish people, and would recognize the God of Israel. However, there was certainly an element among some medieval Jews, a segment of medieval Jewry, who believed that large numbers of non-Jews would be wiped out, and some of them specifically focused on Edom. That is, Christendom would be destroyed, because not only did they persecute Jews, but they worshipped someone other than God as God. There is much to say about this. I won't elaborate, except to say that there is, for me, a fascinating passage in Abarbanel's commentary on Daniel, where, by the logic of his position, he should embrace the view that I just mentioned, namely, that Christendom will be wiped out because of idolatry and the persecution of Jews, but the key is idolatry. Muslims, who are not idolaters, would survive to recognize the God of Israel in a subordinate position. And in fact, he does take this position in a work written shortly after his commentary on Daniel. But in the commentary on Daniel, he has a problem. And that is that he understands the fourth beast in Daniel, that is the fourth kingdom, to embrace both Edom and Yishmael, for reasons that we can't go into right now, for exegetical reasons, for interpretive reasons. He believed that the fourth beast of Daniel was both Edom and Yishmael. And that beast, according to a verse in Daniel, is going to be entirely destroyed. And therefore, for purely exegetical reasons, he has to take a position, he feels impelled to take a position that is contrary to his own logic, and to the eternal misfortune of Muslims, he has to wipe them out. Which really says something about the power of typology to create ideology. Now, at this point, I would like to turn to some texts in a medieval Jewish polemic that I edited once upon a time. Those of you who don't have the handout, maybe I should just pass it down. Okay, are you all right? Very good. Take a look at page 81, please. This is a passage that has to do with taking interest from non-Jews, which, of course, is basically permissible according to halacha, even though taking interest from Jews is not. Mi yagur ba'ohalecha u'mi yishkon b'har kodshecha. Holech tamim u'foel tzedek v'dover emes bilvavo. Lo rogala l'shono v'gomer ad yimot l'olam. Now, what is hidden in the v'gomer is what? The kaspol lo natan v'neshech, right? L'shochad al naki lo lakach, osei eile lo yimot l'olam. Now, this is one of those cases where the gomer is not very well placed. But in any case, this means that a decent person doesn't take interest. Mitoch zeh hamizmor, says the author of the Sefer Nitzachon Yashan, Michorfin osonu hamini, the heretics, something like curse us, but it's not exactly a curse here. V'omrim, why do you take interest from non-Jews? It doesn't distinguish in this passage between the circumcised and the uncircumcised. So, all right, I guess I should not skip anything. Tshuva, this is how you should answer. Mino santa roli Yisrael. God gave the Torah to Israel. V'yad mi v'yad Moshe. U'Moshe amar, l'anochri tashich, u'l'ochicha lo sashich. So you have an explicit verse in the Torah that trumps any sort of implication that you might derive from Psalm 15. V'im tomar, and if you, the Christian, will say, gam b'nei Esav nikra imachim, shene amar, lo sisa'eva domi ki achichahu. After all, we are Edomites, right? Now maybe this means this is what you say about us, right? We're Edomites. So there's an explicit verse in the Torah that says that you should not have disdain for an Edomite because he is your brother. So if it says lo achicha lo sashich, it includes Christians. V'yesh l'hashiv, emesu, shehayu achim ikedem. Once upon a time, they were our brothers. V'ne'esro l'harib bismehem. He's actually saying that when the Torah was originally given, whether he believes this or not is a completely other question, that when the Torah was originally given, it was prohibited to lend money to Edomites. Not Christians, because there were no Christians yet, but it was permissible it was impermissible to take interest from Edomites or pay them interest. But azman shapasales atzmo, until they disqualify themselves, the ata, and now nechshevu bezorim, they are considered aliens. And then he cites what I mentioned earlier: bir osam shecharav beis hamikdash v'lo bol ezra. They did not help when the temple was being destroyed. Shene emar b'yom ha-matcha mineged, b'yom shifos zarim chelol, until the end of the passage in Ovadia. V'chol shekein, the other verse that I mentioned earlier. Asher hein ba'atzma mazru l'achriva. Shene emar, zechor Hashem livnei Edom es yom Yerushalayim, homrim oru oru ad ha-yisod bo. And then he goes on to say they are also not circumcised. And then, there's a point here that's not related to our issue itself, but it's sufficiently interesting that I'll take 2 minutes to comment on it. Look, if you look at the last four lines, he says, "Va'od yesh lahashiv al haribis shemamon kasherhu." Interest is not. There's nothing unethical about taking interest intrinsically. There is a prohibition that the Torah imposed on Jews not to take interest from other Jews for whatever reason. But it's not a moral reason. And this, by the way, was the dominant position of medieval Jews. Chaim Soloveitchik, who studied interest at length, said that there are maybe one or two passages in the Middle Ages in which Jews say something that indicates that there might be some moral problem with interest. That changes in the early modern period, where Jews do start saying that, but not in the Middle Ages. And then he proves it. The author of the Nitzachon Yashan proves this in an absolutely startling way. Shaharei Omar Shlomo, Marbe Hono B'neshech U'Visarbis, V'chonein Dalim Yikvitzenu. Someone who increases his wealth through taking interest is collecting it for one who has mercy on the poor. Kilomar, he says, what this means is, Bitzdokah, Yechupar Havon Sheyeshlo. If you give tzedakah, the sin of taking interest will be atoned for. Ve'ilu hayo gezel me'hayomo il ha-tzedakah. Ve'alo kasuv zevach v'sho'im ta'eva. This is a bizarre passage. Why? What does this pasuk mean? Marbe hono v'neshech v'sarbis v'chonein dalim yikvitzenu. Well, maybe it's yikvitzenu. I didn't look it up. Grammatically, could go either way. So what does that mean? I mean, I'm claiming that this is that the author of the Nitzachon Yashan gives a completely bizarre and untenable explanation, but that's got to mean that there's a straightforward explanation. So I'd like to hear what this means. And transferred by divine providence to a person who cares about the poor. Right, that's what this verse means. It means that somebody who increases his wealth by taking interest is going to lose it as a result of divine providence, and it will go to somebody unlike him who cares about the poor. What you have here is a completely, perverted explanation of this verse in order to establish a position that taking interest is okay. But is morally okay. There's more to say about this point, but this is already outside of our theme, and I want to spend the minutes that I have remaining discussing this passage as it applies to Jews and Christians, as well as a subsequent passage. First of all, there is another remarkable passage, not as remarkable, but very interesting passage that I skipped. There were about three lines that I skipped. I want to go back to one of them, the one that comes after the reference to Shmot Yud Gimel Mem Gimel Mem Chet. Right, he said that the Edomites were responsible for the destruction of the temple. All right. So, the Im Tamar, and if you Christian will say, Im Avos Chote'u, Bonim Me Chote'u, if our ancestors sinned, did we sin also? The Yesh Lomar, and the answer is Dila Olam. This applies indefinitely. The Cholzman Sheomdim B'Mordom or B'Mirdom. As long as they continue to rebel against God, presumably by being happy about the destruction of the temple perpetrated by their ancestors. The reason I find this so interesting is that in the Middle Ages, Jews didn't worry that much about the accusation that they killed Jesus. Because they thought that, first of all, their ancestors did kill Jesus. And number two, this wasn't a mistake. And if they said otherwise, the chances of their being treated any better were marginal anyway. This wasn't going to be a crucial issue as to how they would be treated. So the author of the Nitzachon Yashan has no inhibitions about saying what he said, that a sin that was perpetrated by ancestors continues to cause negative consequences to their descendants many centuries later, as long as the descendants did not repent. Now, of course, this, I think it's of course, at least for me, when I think too much about these matters, this is evocative of the Christian assertion that the Jews are a rejected people, and deserve exile and so on because of their role in the crucifixion. And in the modern period, Jews said what the Second Vatican Council ultimately confirmed, and that is that the ancestors of contemporary Jews did this, but contemporary Jews are not responsible. I have the feeling that in the context of current discussion, no Jew would be comfortable making the argument that appears in this line of the Nitzachon Yashan. I want to look at one more text, but finally, before I go to that text, there is another passage that I did not reproduce for you in the same book, in the Nitzachon Yashan, page 56, if you ever want to look it up, of the English of my English translation, paragraph 20. There is an assertion that goes back to my earlier discussion today, that the blessings that Yitzchak gave were fulfilled for the Gentiles and not the Jews, because those blessings were obtained through trickery. Now, there are other places in Jewish polemical, in Jewish polemical works, in which Jews are, in which Christians are said to criticize Yaakov and other figures in the Tanakh for trickery, for immoral behavior. But here, this is taken as an argument for why the blessings that were given to Yaakov didn't take. But that presupposes something quite surprising, and that is a Christian assumption that the Jews are Yaakov and the Christians or Gentiles are Esav, because the argument is that the blessing that was given to Yaakov didn't work because there was trickery, and that's why they are fulfilled through the Gentiles, which means that the Gentiles are Esav. There are one or two other passages like this in the Nitzachon Yashan, which probably simply means that when it paid, people were prepared to say whatever they felt like saying. And that leads me to the final passage that I want to note, and that is the second page of the handout. But before I get to it, it's directly related to it. One Jew, not a very famous Jew, but Abraham Farisol, who wrote in Italy around 1500, responded to the Christian argument that Jews should not be allowed to take interest from Christians because Christians are Edom, and it says, of Edom, ki achichahu. Right? Farisol said, come on, you know that you're not Edomite. We call you Edomite, but whatever reason we call you Edomite, you're not really Edomite, so just knock it off. That's a kind of interesting observation for a Jew to make in the face of a millennium and more of reflexive Jewish identification of Edom with Christendom, with Rome and then Christendom. And of course, this is one way of cutting the Gordian knot and addressing the question of why Jews should consider Edom, Rome, or Christendom. And the answer of Abraham Farisol is that it's really not so. And so finally, let's look at page 98. Near the beginning. or at the beginning. This is a comment on Psalm 24, the David Mizmor. The Christian is reported to have said in a page that I didn't reproduce that this refers to Jesus, who's the Melech HaKavod, and consequently to Christians who recognize him. And so, if you look at the second line, he says, "Ve'ol lidvarecha, my dichsiv yevakshu fanecha Yaakov sela," that Jacob will seek your presence, that is the presence of God. Chisten hayol olomar. It shouldn't have said yevakshu fanecha Yaakov sela. It should have said yevakshu fanecha Chisten sela. This might have been a funny word to find in Tehillim, but the idea is nonetheless what it is. There is the notion that you are Jacob, that Christians are Jacob, is simply dismissed. Ki hein lo nikru Yaakov, v'lo mi b'nei v'nov heima, ki b'nei esav hein, v'nei kru imedon. And then he goes on to say something that Christian scholars say. Except his word, the author of Nitzachon Yashan, was not worried about saying pejorative things about non-Jews. And so his word for Christian scholars is tipshim. V'yesh tipshim bohem, and there are scholars among them. I mean, just as I would translate a medieval Ashkenazic text that refers to kideshim as saints, I translate tipshim as scholars. There are scholars among them who say, "Kilomi b'nei avos hein, elo b'nei yefes hein, v'avos u'b'nei Yisrael mi b'nei shem hein, u'chnani mi b'nei kenan." So he says that there are Christians who argue that Europeans, and that's true, there were medieval Christians who argued that the people of Europe were descended from Yefet. And one descendant of Yefet is Ashkenaz. And so the author of the Nitzachon Yashan now says, I'm sorry, first he goes on and to explain the point more, V'hagoyim nikroim Ashkenazim, u'lishon b'nei adomu shekorin lohem eretz Ashkenaz. V'af al pi sheyesh bohen hamadabrim lishon laz, some of them speak French. Zeu miyuton. Avolkoli kar hagoyim Ashkenazim heim. This book was written by a German Jew. The Yisrael heim ba'u mishem, v'dichsiv el toldoshem. So you have here a really very interesting Jewish move away from the Edom identification. And affirming a Christian identification as descendants of Yefet, which is not a pejorative identification, because in this context, the Jewish point was made just as effectively this way. So sometimes, because all you have to demonstrate here is that they are not Yaakov. The minute they're not Yaakov, the Jewish polemicist doesn't care what they are. And so you have here a, I think, very interesting unfolding of the impact of a central clash of typologies between Christians and Jews, with all of its sometimes quite significant consequences, both in the real world and in the world of ideas, and in the world of biblical interpretation.